What's the effect of being raised by two mums? Is the child of two lesbian parents different to one raised by a mum and a dad? A long-running study in the USA is trying to answer these sorts of questions. The National Longitudinal Lesbian Family Survey began in the early 1990s, following more than 150 lesbian mothers and their 78 children, and the original kids are now pretty much grown up. Co-author Dr. Nanette Gartrell is a psychiatrist and a distinguished scholar at the UCLA School of Law in Los Angeles, and she joins me on the line. Hello, Nanette.
Hello.
What are the key things you're trying to measure in this study?
In the study, we looked at psychological adjustment of the 17-year-old adolescents who were conceived through donor insemination and raised since birth in what are called planned lesbian families. And we compared their psychological adjustment to children from the normative sample of the same age in a series of measures provided by a standardized instrument of psychological adjustment, a test of psychological adjustment.
Okay, so how was it first set up? Because it, as I mentioned, it goes back to 92, I think.
Actually, we started the study in 1986, so it's almost a quarter century old. And we began during the first wave, the first time that lesbians could obtain sperm from sperm banks in the United States for donor insemination. And we wanted to follow the first generation of children who were conceived through donor insemination from the moment of almost conception, preconception or pregnancy, until they grew up or even longer.
So how do you get the information? Is it a checklist from the mothers themselves?
The way we obtained the information for this current part of the study is that we had the mothers complete a very detailed behavioral checklist with over 100 items about their 17-year-old adolescents, asking everything about aggressive behavior and social behavior and academic performance and so on. And it's a standardized checklist. The mothers completed this checklist, and then the scores were tabulated and statistically compared to the normative sample of children who are raised in normative families in the United States.
Isn't there always, though, an issue with self-reporting? Because it's not as reliable, it's certainly not the same as objective measurement.
Well, in this most recent round of data gathering, we also obtained an enormous amount of data from the adolescents themselves, which has yet to be analyzed. That also includes a number of standardized tests. But the one that we use, the Achenbach Child Behavior Checklist, for this most recent report that we just published, is a test that is used internationally. It has been used for decades. It's considered a very reputable test, and it has been designed to be used to assess the behavior psychological adjustment of any one child or for research purposes for groups to compare with other groups.
Okay, so you essentially you're happy with the robustness of it.
I am happy with the robustness of the standardized instrument that has been used.
What were, you mentioned that you've spoken to the kids at 17. I think you spoke to them at 10 as well. What questions were they asked? Give me an example of the questions to the 17-year-olds.
Well, what we have not yet analyzed is an enormous amount of data about the adolescents' assessment of their own lives, their goals, dreams, aspirations, their comfort, discomfort growing up in a house where they were reared by lesbian mothers, their experiences of bullying and homophobia and stigmatization, their own sexual orientation, their own sexual behavior, lifetime sexual behavior. We have many, many, many things that we would like to report on about these children. We plan to report on about them, and we have not yet even begun to analyze all those data.
So all you've looked at so far is what the parents say, essentially.
How the parents rate their own children's behavior.
Right, and you compare that with how a bunch of parents who are essentially straight couples rate their children's behavior.
That's exactly right.
Okay, so what are the results?
The results are that on psychological adjustment, the adolescents reared in lesbian families scored higher on social academic and overall competence, and lower in aggressive behavior, rule-breaking, and social problems than the age-matched adolescents in the normative sample.
Right. That is quite marked, isn't it? Quite profound. Was it the same for girls and boys?
It was the same for girls and boys, and I must say that I was surprised by the findings. I actually expected the adolescents in the lesbian group either to show some signs of distress because of expected and known stigmatization, or to have psychological adjustment that was essentially comparable to their peers, because certainly there are many, many, many children raised by same-sex parents, and we do know, I'm a psychiatrist, I do know from my own practice, that these kids look as though they're doing fine, but I was very surprised to see that this group of adolescents was even doing better in some respects.
On Life Matters today, my guest is Dr. Nanette Gartrell. She's a psychiatrist. She's also a distinguished scholar at the UCLA School of Law. And she's one of the authors of the latest part of a survey that goes back. Its originations are in 1986, and it's been following lesbian families for a long time. And we are hearing, I suppose, the latest results on how the kids of lesbian mothers are going. Now, the fact that your results show that these adolescents are, broadly speaking, doing better than their peers in straight families, why do you think that might be?
Well, I think it has a lot to do with the fact that these children were highly desired. There were no accidents. There were no broken condoms. These children, the mothers worked very hard to become parents. So any child that's born into a family in which the child is desired and the birth is looked forward to and the parents really are interested in being parents and committing their lives to rearing children in a healthy way, those children inevitably have a leg up in life. And on top of that, these mothers provided the nurturing and love and support that every child needs. In addition, because they anticipated that their children would be stigmatized for growing up in a lesbian family, the mothers were very actively involved in their children's lives in a very positive way, such as they really worked very effectively at trying to pave the way for their children so that they would experience as little discrimination as possible.
So you think this is about, fundamentally, parental motivation and engagement?
I think it's very much about parental motivation and engagement, and I've been asked a lot in recent weeks whether we are concluding that this means that lesbian families are better than any other kind of family, and that's not at all what we're concluding. What we're concluding is that parents who desire children, who plan for children, who work very hard at being parents, who are very thoughtful about parenting, have excellent outcomes. That's the best that can be.
The other thing, though, I understand is that there are different disciplinary styles showing up between essentially the lesbian couples and the straight couples.
There are some studies that have come out of the UK by Susan Golombach and Fiona Tasker that have compared children reared in lesbian families, these are younger children, and children reared in heterosexual families, and found a difference in the use of corporal punishment, essentially spanking, in the two kinds of families, that there was much more of it in the mom-dad families than there was in the lesbian families. And we know that violence toward children can beget violence. So that is something that I think is a factor when we look at the fact that our lesbian mothers told us consistently that they did not use corporal punishment with their children.
Do you think there are lessons in this research, which I know you're still dealing with and you've got more to do on, for all parents?
I think there are lessons for all parents. I think, first of all, it's wonderful when children are desired. That's a terrific thing. And it's also very important to be involved in your children's lives. These mothers, because they were concerned about stigmatization, and the fact is that every child, even if the child is not a member of a non-majority group, experiences some bullying in school or some hostility for whatever reason. And these mothers, the lesbian mothers were actively involved in the schools in developing anti-bullying and diversity appreciation programs that benefit all children, not just their children. So I think very much attention to those kinds of appreciation of difference. I mean, most of the conflict in the world comes from people fearing difference and that being instituted at an early age. So these mothers worked to undo that kind of fear, and I think that's a wonderful thing.
There has been research that I've seen and we've talked about on this show before about the importance of fathers in children's lives, especially in adolescence, and also for adolescent boys, the importance of other male role models. Is there any sense in which these mothers are aware of that research and are concerned that those male role models are in their children's lives?
Absolutely, and that's something we asked about from the very beginning before the children were even born. We were very interested in whether the mothers intended to provide male role models. And what we heard from them is that that was very important to them, but when we further delved into the concept of what a good role model was, they kept saying to us that they certainly want to have good, loving men in their children's lives, that they expected to provide such for their children, but that the characteristics that made somebody a good human being were not gender specific. So they wanted loving, communicative, kind, supportive men in their children's lives, and they worked to provide that for their children.
Now, this study looked solely at planned lesbian families. Is there any research that you know of looking at children growing up with two fathers?
There is such research. Dr. Henny Bose, my collaborator on this study, is a professor at the University of Amsterdam, and she has just had another paper accepted on gay dads in the Netherlands, and there are some other studies that are happening in the United States that are not yet at the publication stage. So research is forthcoming. There are also other individuals who are replicating my study design following families of gay men longitudinally. But what I have to keep reminding people this day and age is that we live in such an era where we expect things to happen instantly, and in fact, my study has been in existence for 24 years, and unfortunately, that has to happen in real time,
yes.
Something we're not too familiar with any longer.
It's essentially a matter of the fact that the two gay dads phenomenon is more recent than two lesbian women deciding to have a child, which, as you say, goes back to the 1980s and early 90s.
That's right. And also there are fewer gay dads because gay dads become dads through about five different methods. One is they are raising children of their relatives when they have relatives who for one reason or other cannot rear those children. Another route is that they donate sperm to lesbians who want to have children and as a larger extended family rear the children. It's very difficult for gay men to adopt or foster children in the United States, but some are able to do that, but it's illegal still in many places. And then, of course, there's surrogacy, and that's very, very costly, and so that's limited only to men who have a tremendous amount of money, and that's a very small part of the population.
Going back to the study that you are a part of, it's ongoing. It's been going a long time. How long do you plan to follow these families?
Well, I originally said that I would follow them until the children were 25 so that at that moment I could answer the question that everyone wants to know, what will the sexual orientation of these young people be? But about 5 years ago, when Dr. Henny Bose asked if I would be interested in collaborating with me and told me that she loves doing statistics and she drinks 12 cups of espresso a day, so she essentially doesn't sleep, and she's 20 years younger than I am, I said, you're signed on. And then she followed that up by telling me she would like to follow these families until the offspring, the 17-year-olds now, have grandchildren. I said, go for it.
Yeah, so knock yourself out.
Right.
All right, well, then we can expect more in the future. Thank you very much for joining us today, Nanette.
Thank you for having me.
That was Dr. Nanette Gartrell. She's Williams Distinguished Scholar at the UCLA School of Law and Associate Clinical Professor of Psychiatry. That's her qualification at the University of California in San Francisco. And if you head to our website, you'll find a link to the full report. Of course, that's at abc.net.au/rn/lifematters. And while you're there, use the story-based commenting. Keen to hear from you on this. The number to call also is 02833 1430. This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National, and I'm Richard Adie.